This is so strange. But the minute I set foot inside a theatre, I knew it was for me.
Really?
And, yes, and my poor parents were a little bit nonplussed. You know, they couldn't imagine anybody going into such a career of so many vagaries and difficulties. But that was what I wanted to do. And always, and said that's what I would do. I was interested in performing, but also in directing and writing from an early age. And I think if I hadn't gone into theatre, I would have been doing something with writing. English was certainly my forte, and languages. So I was always destined for the arts field. I was determined that theatre was my home.
Welcome back to Herstory. This series gets stuck into the stories of inductees to the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. My name's Taylor Strano. I'm with you each week as we meet some of the trailblazing women who've called WA their home. In episode 10, we meet Jenny Davis. From a young age, Jenny knew she was determined for the theatre. From writing and directing to starring at centre stage, telling stories was always the calling for Jenny. It wasn't until later she started capturing the stories of everyday Australians and bringing them to life in the theatre. Jenny is determined to show that everyone has a story, one worth telling. It's season 2, episode 10 of Herstory with Jenny Davis. This is Her Story. Tell me a little bit about growing up. Whereabouts in the UK are you from?
Well, I was born not far from London in Surrey, quite leafy Surrey, a very pleasant little town called Walton-on-Thames. But it was a great position for someone who became interested in theatre really, really early. My family weren't theatrical, but my parents were theatre-goers, and I was taken to the London theatres from a very young age, sort of 4 or 5 upwards. And the minute This is so strange. But the minute I set foot inside a theatre, I knew it was for me.
Really?
And, yes, and my poor parents were a little bit nonplussed. You know, they couldn't imagine anybody going into such a career of so many vagaries and difficulties. But that was what I wanted to do. And always, and said that's what I would do. I was interested in performing, but also in directing and writing from an early age. And I think if I hadn't gone into theatre, I would have been doing something with writing. English was certainly my forte, and languages. I was always destined for the arts field. I was determined that theatre was my home. And I used to say when I was a child, I'm sure I was an actor in another life because I feel as though I know all these people and what they do. So I think I was very fortunate in many ways because I always knew what I wanted to do. But at the same time, I suppose I kind of narrowed my field so much that I didn't really consider anything else, which, you know, perhaps wasn't such a good idea. But anyway, I feel I've been extremely fortunate because I've spent my whole life really pursuing my passion.
Mm. It's one thing to know what you want to do. It's another thing to actually go out and achieve it.
Yes, yes, that is harder. I did go to a drama school. I went to Central School of Speech and Drama. But my father was adamant that I must have a proper qualification. So I did get a teaching diploma. In those days, teaching was a diploma back in the 60s, so, or, you know, rather than degree. So I did get a teaching diploma in drama, and voice really was my thing, from London University. And I have used it as a backstop over the years, but I honestly think I was a pretty useless teacher at that age. You know, I feel like a much better teacher in my old age than I ever would have been, you know, age 21 or whatever it was when I was starting out.
Well, you've lived some life at this point,
well,
too.
Well, this is it. And I think in the world of theatre and drama, you know, your life experience counts a lot. I have enjoyed, I've always been interested in the spoken word, well, and the written word, but also the voice. So I was, you know, I did enjoy working with young people, old people, whoever, well, particularly young people, I suppose, developing vocal techniques and learning accents and that kind of thing. You have to have a good ear if you're going to be a performer in the theatre. And so I just I'm fascinated with words, really, and the value of words. And one of the things I love as a grandmother is being able to impart that to my grandchildren.
I feel like when somebody gets into theatre or when they see themselves in a career, a lifelong love affair with theatre, confidence has to be one of those things that continues to propel you. Were you always a confident child? Did you always want to be on the stage?
Yes, I was pretty confident as a child, probably more confident as a child than in later years. But I think that does happen. There is a kind of attrition in your confidence in performing, because it comes so much more easily when you're young. Yes, I was confident. I wasn't confident about being successful, but I certainly felt that I could do the job to the, you know, I mean, everybody has a limited capacity to what you're suitable to play and to be cast in. But I did feel that I understood the bones of theatre and performing. And that's really, I guess, why I'm also drawn to directing and not just performing. I like the big picture. Mm. And now, of course, mainly, which we'll get to later, I'm sure, but I'm a writer. But in the early days, as well as acting, I did love directing. And for many years, that became my kind of key thing. Getting into the business is really hard. That is the thing you have to tell most people who are starting out and very passionate about it, that I always say to everybody, as long as you have a creative project in hand, it doesn't matter whether it's going to be an Oscar nomination or a small community theatre down the road. That's what drives you. That's what feeds your passion. So always have something creative in the process. And it's a lot of hanging around, knocking on doors, getting to know people, like all industries, I suppose, but waiting for your moment when someone sees your potential. So it does require a fair amount of passion, volunteering, turning up, basically, and being a very responsible company member and good to work with and keen, basically, mm-hmm. and hardworking, and keeping fit. You have to be physically fit.
I can only imagine. So I feel like we're sitting in the middle of a Whopper masterclass right now. This is wonderful.
Well, yeah, I did do some teaching in Whopper in the early days. I don't so much now, but yeah, I love working with young people. The older I get, the more I love working with young people. It's just invigorating, you know, when you get into your 70s to be able to share something and live a little bit of life. Well, you feel connected to the world when you're still working with young people.
Young people also have that beautiful thing where their ability to play is still so fresh in mind as well.
Yes. Yes. And but the interesting thing is that being an actor does allow you to keep a little bit of that ability. And I think even, you know, people, actors in their senior years still have that quality. And it's the one thing that, you know, we love, is it does keeping you playful, keeping you curious, I think, and empathetic, all those things that make you feel you spend your life observing people, even without knowing, because you're collecting information about, you know, that you can use on stage. It's not that you go out looking at people saying, now, what can I learn about you? Well, occasionally you need to do that. But mostly it's a case of just feeling like your pores are open to absorbing things about people and characteristics and what makes people tick, the psychology of it all. Quite a few actors that I know have gone on to become psychologists, gone on to do psychology. I think because they get so enthralled with that journey, that process of walking in somebody else's shoes.
I want to just change direction for a moment, Jenny, and talk about your move from the UK to Perth that happened in 1976. What prompted the decision to make the big move?
Yes, it's a good question. Because my husband and I, because we came together, because we were married very young when I was still at drama school, actually. And we often look back and think, wow, that was a big decision. It seemed so easy then when you're young to do these things and you're adventurous. We were both kind of starting out and we hadn't really made an impact anywhere yet. But we did have, because we got married young, we had two small children. And we thought, well, what we want to do is have an adventure and live somewhere else before the children start school. And my husband, coming from the far north of Scotland, wanted to live somewhere warm for a bit. So we thought Australia is young. Well, it's a young, old society. It's a fascinating society, actually, isn't it? Because you've got the ancient land and the ancient culture and then this sort of modern culture superimposed. And in those respects, it was quite a young nation. And the Australians we'd met in the UK, who were young travellers, you know, from inveterate travellers, really fascinated us with their, what is it about West Australians particularly? It's something about the wide open landscape. It gives them a great kind of expansiveness, you know, and energy and yes, I can do this. And so we were certainly attracted to Western Australia for that kind of zeitgeist, I suppose. So we thought, well, I didn't tell my mother. Well, I did tell my mother I was only going for 2 years. I didn't tell her I might be going forever. But she may have suspected. But we came really just to see how we went. And we weren't expecting that when we arrived, there was such a vibrant theatrical community here at the time. In many ways, more vibrant than now, in as much as that audiences were really regular theatre goers in Perth back then, and it's, of course, there's so many other things to attract audiences now. And there were at least three major theatre companies doing 12 shows a year with big casts. There was plenty of work, and the ABC and various places. So we actually started working, and then, you know, because we were mainly actors in those days, one job leads to another and you don't want to sort of turn a job down, and suddenly you think, oh, hello, maybe this is where we live now. So it comes upon you quite gradually. And by the time the children were ready to start school, we felt very much this was our community. And I think one of the things is that we both love living in a small city. London is still my heart's home in some ways. I love the architecture of England and some of the, yeah, and the topography and, you know, the scenery and stuff, because that's where I grew up. But I also love the Australian bush and everything about Australia now. So for a little while, I did feel quite torn, but by now, this is where my heart lies. It's fascinating. And London is a wonderful city, very vibrant. I love going back there to visit, but you have to have very sharp elbows to live in London or any big city like that. I think Perth, to me, is an ideal size city because it still feels like a community in many ways.
It's so interesting you mentioned there about arriving in Western Australia in the mid-1970s and in the early 80s, the theatre community was so strong and vibrant and very clearly represented across stages in WA, which could also possibly be the reason for its dwindling or decline in the last few years, because it is such an isolated place in Western Australia. So at those times, I can understand there's nobody else around and it's a lot harder to get to and from. And as a working actor and theatre maker at the time, it's great because you've got your pick of the crop in WA, and now it's a little bit more competitive.
Well, yes. Yes, you're right in most of what you say, because the isolation is always feels like an advantage and a drawback at the same time. But then wherever you live presents its challenges. I think when you meet, as a lot of West Australian artists leave, of course, and go international and eastern states, and when you meet them overseas, you do recognise that energy that I was talking about, that entrepreneurial kind of aspect of people. It's a strange thing, but when I'm in London and if I go to see anything, like the ballet or something, I always feel I can pick Australian dancers, particularly West Australian, there's something different about them. I love that.
The isolation almost like breeds or demands this air of creativity about the people, doesn't it?
It does. It really does. It's a different feeling. I think some of the reasons now are, well, I mean, it's great that it's easier to travel. Well, it will be again. I mean, it has been difficult the last couple of years, but it's opening up now. And in fact, the company that we have now is about to go interstate. So it's great that we can travel. Well, we did go on tour, you know, even back then. I mean, I've toured with my own company and or our own company over the years. Even in the early years, I toured not just WA, but interstate, nationally and internationally. New Zealand, been to Brazil, to London. So one of the benefits of being an actor, actually, is being able to work around the world, and so that you're not just there as a tourist, but you're working in places. You meet interesting people that you might not as a tourist. So I haven't really felt confined by living here. I have felt augmented, I think, by living here. As you can hear, I've never lost my Britishness.
That's with you for life.
I'm afraid it is, really. You know, I love all the things that kind of created me, and hate some of them, of course, as one does when you look at history. But it's because in the last 30 years, I have been working very deliberately in the community, gathering oral histories and putting oral histories on stage. That has been a fantastic way for me of becoming truly as Australian as I can be, having come from somewhere else in the first place. I mean, we became Australian citizens very early on. We hadn't been here a very short time. But it's still because I didn't grow up here and I wasn't so connected to the history, I still really only knew the Australia from 1976 onwards. And now, with the kind of work I've done, first with Age Link Theatre, and now we've morphed into Theatre 180, the work I've done, working mostly with seniors, but with all sorts of people and all sorts of walks of life with oral histories, I feel I know much more about what it feels like to be Australian, and I love that.
Let's dive into Age Link Theatre, which has eventually become Theatre 180. Take us back to the start, though. Where did this interest in combining arts and aged healthcare come from for you?
Well, it started when my dad was dying in England, and in the last sort of year of his life, he had to go into care, and I went back to see him. And my intention was to record his stories because he was a great raconteur about his childhood in London, which was, you know, in World War One, and then the in between the two wars years and the war stories that he had in World War Two. And he was in the RAF, and so was my mum. And I thought, well, this is a great time to get them down on record them for posterity and then use them some way, I don't know, make something out of them. Because his stories of when he was a child of London, it was almost like a Dickensian London, peopled with amazing characters and that kind of thing. And by the time I got back to spend some time with him, it was actually too late to do that. He wasn't able to speak very much. And I really felt annoyed with myself. I realised then that I've always enjoyed the company of seniors. I mean, I'm a senior myself now, but I wasn't then. And I've always enjoyed listening to their stories, even as a small child. And I really wanted, looking at my dad in the nursing home, I wanted to really affirm the value of people and their stories and how their legacy of the past, learning through them, through individual stories about the past, is one of the best ways of understanding the political past, really. I mean, the bigger scene. And because we're all human, we all have the same kind of, not the same experiences, but the same kind of emotional reactions to experiences, so we can all relate to things that happened in the past. But this is how we learn and makes history most accessible, is to learn it from individuals and to make it accessible to a big number of people to put it on stage. So that's really what started me in the first place, thinking, when I go back to Australia, I want to start working with talking to old people, recording stories, gathering oral histories, and working them into shows. And so AgeLink was a little tiny company then that was born out of the idea of bringing generations together so that there was more intergenerational understanding. I think back, this is in the early 90s, and there was still very much a youth culture. We weren't, it was amazing how in 2000 that just turning the millennium suddenly made people feel like the previous century was the past and started getting more interested in people's
stories. They were nostalgic
story.
For yeah, it.
Suddenly, yes, it was very interesting. But it felt in the early 90s that older people were not as valued as they might be in other cultures here in Australia. So I really wanted to gather those stories for myself and for other people, and also at the same time to say to the people who are giving their stories, look, you are important. Look what you've learned, and we can profit by it, because if we don't know about our past, we're not really informing our present. And how can we move forward into the future? You know, I mean, let's face it, we still go forward and make the same mistakes very often. But nevertheless, it's good to have some knowledge, you know.
And a record of it, too.
Yes, yes. So it's been such a joy. I can't tell you. I feel so fortunate. I've met so many interesting people from so many backgrounds. And whomever you interview, well, I'm sure you have the same experience as an interviewer, people will say, oh, well, I don't know that I'm very interesting. And then they tell you some, you know, wonderful stuff, because everybody's experiences are interesting. Isn't that why maybe as we get older, I find people are quite interested, more interested perhaps in biographies and autobiographies in many cases than they were when they were young, because you start looking back at your own life and seeing the patterns and working out, you know, where you've come and why. And it's just fascinating, really.
From UFO sightings to abandoned theme parks and tank rampages across the CBD, Planet Perth is your guide to the weird, wacky and unexplained history of our eccentric city. Planet Perth. Stream now on iTunes, Spotify and rtrfm.com.au.
There's something to be said about when a really famous musician passes away and the world goes into mourning for that person, and then we, in our own sort of way of closure, we go, well, we have all their music to cherish and celebrate their life through. And you're right, it's funny when you speak to everyday people and they say, what have I got to offer? Or my stories aren't any different to the guy that lives next door. But they are the stories that are inherently human that make it all the more interesting. And really, like, no offence to all of the very famous musicians and their contributions to music in the world, but they're the ones that people can identify with maybe more so than, say, a deluxe edition album that somebody put out.
Yes. Well, I'm pretty sure I agree with all of that. I mean, everybody has value and everybody's take on things is slightly different. I always remember I was working with Barbara Harper Nelson, whose husband, John Harper Nelson, was an ABC presenter for many years. And Barbara had a wonderful story pre-marriage of a romance she had with during World War II in England with a young French airman. And she had beautiful letters and poems he wrote her. And I said, I'd done a lot of war stories at the time, and I was saying, I don't know if I want to do another war story. And then I read these letters and I thought, oh my goodness, I have to do this. They're so beautiful. So we wrote a play about her and her fiancé called Cécine Barbiche. He was French, and so that was the way he called her, Barbiche, and his name was Francis. And we took it to England as well. But I'm going in a very roundabout way to say that when I was talking to Barbara, she had not only letters, she had journals that she kept since the outbreak of war in 1939 when she was only a teenager. And she'd written in these journals, she had cupboards full of them, every single day of her life, and she was now 90.
Oh, my gosh.
I said, that's an enormous provenance for somebody, you know. But her sister, Patricia, also kept a journal. And I mean, how close are sisters there? I mean, because her sister had moved here too in later years. And so you wouldn't expect them to have different, necessarily, experiences. But they loved to do a thing. They'd say, right, look at, you know, January the 2nd, 1953. What have you got? And then they would compare notes. And it was fascinating because they were talking about the same world events, the same family events, but they had different attitudes, different emotional reactions. They experienced it differently. It's really interesting. But really, I guess the essence of creating plays out of individual stories is because, I'm trying to think of a quote, it's Scott Fitzgerald's quote, which is something about if you take the particular, then you have a story. You can't just take a generalization. It actually doesn't mean very much. It's not until you take the particular and set it within a context that you really learn about humanity and, as it happens, history. But, that's sort of a by the way, really. It's the whole essence of theatre is about telling stories, really, isn't it?
Well, in human stories, the things that make the world go round and give us understanding in that context. With all these stories that you've recorded and the theatre that's come from those moments sitting with people who are maybe on their deathbed or maybe in the later stages of life, when those shows eventually make it to the stage, I'm imagining the family of those people get to see it. What's their reaction like?
Oh, yes. And that's one of the joys, really, because it's like a gift to the family. Well, you hope it's like a gift. This is the thing, the nub of it is that you're doing things with love and respect. So you may have to put things on stage that are uncomfortable or very poignant, funny. I mean, you're looking for things always that will make good theatre, but, you know, you've got to be, you have to have integrity. You have to be really true to the stories and the way people tell them and their voice. But I have never, fortunately, always, to start to prefix that, always you show them the material before you get permission for the material to be used once it's created. And people always look at you in a perplexed way and say, how are you going to tell my story on stage? How's that going to work? I said, well, actually, I don't know. Not until I get everything together and can draw all the threads out and see, you know, what the pathways are, what the journey is. But somehow it always seems to work. And somehow I have never yet had anybody say to me, you know, I'm don't do that. I wish you hadn't told that story. I mean, obviously, they might say, look, I don't want this mentioned because it's sensitive and somebody's still alive and so you don't mention that. You know, I can't say that I've ever found anybody experience anything but joy from having their story told. I think we all like to reminisce ourselves. It's part of life, isn't it? I mean, even I'm thinking of my youngest grandchild, who's now 12, but even when she was little, when she was 4 or 5, she would say, tell me a story about when I was a baby and what I did and that kind of thing. It's just natural that we all look back at any age to understand ourselves on the journey of life. So one of the interesting things, though, that we started doing in the last sort of 15 years is working with people with dementia. To begin with, you know, I was imagined, like everybody else, that it wouldn't be very good, useful material. But the thing is, memories don't have to be linear. They can be really absorbing, you know, anyway, without actually being able to place them on a particular day, time, moment. And what I do with reminiscence workshops with people with dementia is we have a group and we use a lot of things like music and tangible things like smells and objects and fabrics and all sorts of things just to sort of get people talking and amongst themselves. And then we just pick up little moments of their lives that I can put on stage as a group rather than just probably one person's story. And then the families can all be there. Usually it's something small that we do. It might be in a theatre space, but it might just be in the wherever they live, in the facility they live. All the families come, professional actors and musicians, play out the stories, acknowledging that people in the audience, this is your story, this is... So sometimes we have something like a tree with leaves on with people's stories, and people can take a leaf off and now we'll play this story. It's just so enchanting, and I usually try and involve children in it as well because of that intergenerational thing, and they can play the very young, the person when they were very young, and it's just joyful. It's not going to be world shattering. It's not going to, you know, it's not going to take us to the Academy Awards or anything like that. But it's so lovely, and yeah, it gives. It's not just for them because you do see them light up and enjoy it, but it's also for the families. It's a gift to see what they can do rather than what they can't, and it's a way of all coming together and celebrating them. So yeah, it's very joyful. It's lovely.
In some particular circumstances, when people are living with dementia as well, it's very hard to remember our family members and remember our friends at a time in their life when they weren't living with dementia. So having these moments of theatre is sometimes just giving the family and giving the audience that opportunity, and even the person who lives with dementia, that shiny little moment of remember this, and you also used to act like this, and this is also a story from your, you know, life story as well. I imagine that in itself is just completely invaluable. And you've talked about the impact and the joy that it brings to the people whose stories are being told and their family and friends. But what about for you, Jenny? Why is it that you want to continue making these pieces of theatre?
Well, it brings me great joy just to see it grow and see the response, you know. But because you're always learning, I suppose, and I don't know. It's just, I can't tell you exactly why, but it gives me great pleasure. And also what's interesting is that the people who are in the position of caring in the facilities also really enjoy it, and they get to see an aspect very often of the people they're caring for that they don't normally have time to, you know, delve themselves. And it changes everybody's attitude to the people, I think. There's so often, and other people who live with them in the facilities, they, you know, never knew this about, or they never even knew that they were a famous pianist, or also, you know, it's amazing what people don't know about. And you, it's fascinating, isn't it? You always think, oh, my family know all about me, but probably they don't, and I have to sit down and write my story probably one day. And I'm always saying that to everywhere I go, please write this down, write your stories for your families, because there's one, a day will come when they'll want to know and you won't be here to tell them, you know. And nowadays, of course, we don't have the luxury, or will not have the luxury, of letters and diaries and things as a provenance for researchers. So I know the lot will be recorded, I suppose, digitally, but who knows how ephemeral those things will be, whether we'll, you know, I guess if they're sort of out there forever in some respects. But there's also something about when people write something themselves, there's something about the care and the trouble they take putting pen to paper that makes a letter from a long while ago so fascinating. It's like you can put your heart and soul into a letter that you might not into an email in the
same
way.
Well, it's done with such intention, right?
Yes.
As opposed to not to, you know, I'm a millennial, I'm a digital native, I will snap my way into oblivion. But it's something very different about intentionally sitting down and writing something as it is to popping a photo online with maybe four words underneath it. They tell very different stories about who you are as a person.
Yes, they do. It's the connection that you feel to this person is very tangible. Yeah, I'm lucky that obviously we still have those things that I've been able to use for research and as a basis for a lot of the work I do. Also, of course, AgeLink grew a lot over the years. It was funny because I started out, it'll make you laugh, but I started out with it called AgeLink Reminiscence Theatre. But after a while, it became AgeLink Theatre because people find it so hard to spell reminiscence.
It's not good for your search engine optimization, really, is it?
I never thought of that when we started. It just felt like ART, A-R-T, what a great acronym, you know that? So it became Aisling Theatre. And then when after 30 years, really, of work, and I started to think, well, I won't be doing this forever. I need a succession plan. And fortunately, my wonderful daughter, Rebecca Davis, who's an actress and also a wonderful business manager, as it turns out, and my son-in-law, Stuart Hallis, who's an actor and a really fine director, they'd come back to live in Perth after doing their stints, as one does, you know, elsewhere, to raise a family. Stuart had been working as an associate director at Black Swan, and I said to them, what do you think about taking a company forward in your own way? And they loved the idea. They decided they were going to stay here. They're committed to Perth, so they, and WA. So they now sort of at the helm. We have a wonderful board, but they're at the helm of the association. And I'm no longer the artistic director, but I'm still very much involved and I'm still on the board. And I'm mostly writing these days, which suits me very well because I love writing the plays and the stories. And then a remarkable thing happened just before COVID. We were looking at a way to present the story of A Fortunate Life, A.P. Face's autobiographical account of his life, which has been hugely popular. It was written in 1983, I think, but hugely popular the world over. It sold like thousands of copies internationally. And it's a big story because it's 80 years of life, but it's a quintessential story of growing up in the bush and through the war, depression, the wars. Really, it's kind of, this is WA, this story. And wherever you go in the country, around WA, rural WA, you find Bert Albert Facey worked there at some stage. How do you put this story on stage? Well, we originally had an idea for a big cast of 10 actors, and we weren't going to get funding at that stage for at the moment, at that stage in time, for a show this big. So we were having to, as one often does, and it's often a very good thing to do, we were having to rethink. I suppose compromise is one word, but more like evolve, I suppose, or turn on a pivot and think, well, all right, what else can we do? And it just so happened that Ron Siemieniowski of Arana Cinemas was very interested in utilising cinemas in a different way rather than just having movies, which, you know, is a difficult time for cinemas at the moment, especially COVID and post-COVID. And if you haven't got a big blockbuster on, you know, and there's so much streaming, other places you can see films, it's hard to attract people to cinemas. So we had this idea of performing theatre in the cinema. And we have a stage that is created so that it can be any height, so that it can be at the bottom of the screen, so that the actors can be working against the screen. And then we film all the backdrops, so there's virtually no set on stage, all the backdrops and all sorts of content is filmed for the hour and three quarters of the play. And the actors are wired to the sort of cinema sound. So you can sit in comfort in the cinema, you get the whole cinematic experience and live actors in front of you performing. It turned out to be really magical. The first show, as I say, was A Fortunate Life, and it was a bit heart in mouth. Is this going to work? Well, it's 3 years now, and it's still playing. We've done 110 performances. It's about to go on tour again around WA and then go over east. It's been not only in cinemas all around the state, we actually were lucky enough to get a Lottery West grant for a massive cinema screen that folds down into a box and a projector so we can put everything on the trailer and take it anywhere. We go to tiny towns. I mean, our next tour, we're going to places like West Arthur and Boyup Brook, but places much smaller than that even. So that this fulfills our charter of Theatre 180, which the company is now called. Because Theatre 180, the idea 180, is like sort of all degrees of generations, but also of audiences. And this fulfills our charter of being able to take theatre anywhere to you. You don't have to come to us. And it's accessible. And it's also accessible for more for people than having to go to the costs of putting a show on in a big theatre are huge. And so ticket prices reflect that. But if you're going to your local cinema, you may never have been to the theatre before and not even be interested in theatre, but you do like going to the cinema. And there, you know, it's a wonderful experience. So it's been terrific. And then since then, I've done, wrote about the HMAS Sydney, called Sydney 2, Lost and Found, about the sinking of the Sydney and the finding of it. That was for the anniversary of that, in 80th anniversary of the sinking. And that's going out on tour again this year. And our third one, which is in production now, which is called The Lighthouse Girls Saga, which is Diane Wolfer's four books, starting with The Lighthouse Girl in Albany as a story in World War One about a girl in a lighthouse, and then following through with other three other books, really all about World War One, but all about connected characters. And that's in production now, and that's a collaboration writing between myself and Hilly Turner. And that starts in Albany in February and then works its way out towards Perth. And so this year we've got three of those shows all touring at the same time, which means that we've having to expand a lot as a company. But it's just incredibly fortunate that we can do that, so as well as do the kind of stuff in the community and main stage work and reach everybody. This is what we love. and it all started with Age Link Theatre, which was theatre in a suitcase, where you'd arrive somewhere, we'd say, we can perform anywhere, in the corner of a room. And we'd arrive with our actors and our suitcase of little bits and pieces and our soundtrack, and off we go.
I love that despite not being the artistic director anymore, you still seem to somehow be one of the busiest working theatre makers I know.
I'm very lucky now because I don't have to do the hard graft. I don't have to do the stuff like selling the tickets, you know, all that kind of thing, box office, organising insurances and wages.
That's your daughter's problem.
Yes,
now.
Or even cleaning the toilets or whatever. No. Rebecca, who's also an actor at the same time, she's living my life. She's even busier than I was at that stage and bringing up a family. What? I love this. I love about women. Women are so good at juggling all these things successfully.
We've had to. I love the testament to the longevity of live theatre, particularly Western Australian live theatre, just based on the rundown you've given us there for the 2023 seasons for Theatre 180. It is so nice to know that through COVID and through lockdowns and border closures and people not sure if they had a job to go back to, that theatre and Western Australian and Australian stories were still being told on stage. And that was a commitment that Theatre 180 really made to themselves.
Yes, absolutely. Being able to use West Australian stories and using West Australian creatives and artists and actors and technicians really is what we're about. And if you've got something, a clear direction like that, it gives you that vibrancy that you need. And as I say, we have a wonderful board supporting us, a lot of people, a lot of volunteers help, and we have a great database of audience members now. So yeah, it feels like a big ever expanding family, I suppose, but I'm just so lucky to be able to just do the bits that I like, really, and watch them all scurrying around furiously saying bravo, well done, and yes, I will pick up the children from school.
Everybody, don't touch any more of the frogs, okay?
But that's good grandma energy right there. Yeah. Jenny, it is no surprise that you were inducted to the Hall of Fame through your work at the West Australian Youth Theatre Company, through AgeLink Theatre, Theatre 180 and everything else in between. Being inducted in 2017, what was it like when you received the phone call to say, hello, we're the Hall of Fame and we would like to induct OAM Jenny Davis?
I am ashamed to say that I didn't know much about it until that moment, so I was quite surprised, but delighted, yes, because I'd almost awarded out at that moment because I'd had the Senior of the Year, which was so lovely, WA Senior of the Year in 2016, and then the OAM, and I was kind of reeling from all that and thinking, you know, the thing about awards is that it's so lovely that your peers recognize you and nominate you, and you know, you receive these awards. But you also want to say, oh Lord, it's not just me. I'm only here because of all the people that are underpinning what I do. And, you know, so you have that kind of chagrin of being really pleased and excited, but also feeling a bit, not embarrassed isn't the right word, but mortified that you can't just do it for everybody, you know. That so I have to say to everybody, I'm here representing you. It's not just me. So when I had that call, I was really excited, but almost saying, oh no, is this too much? But I tell you what, it was so delightful being part of that huge group of women that I met because of the ones who were nominated with me that year, but also, you know, previous years and the subsequent years. I mean, you and I were saying earlier, it's incredible. It's a way of meeting people from all walks of life. I mean, there are people there not just from the arts, but from the sciences, education, academia, medicine, law, charities, sport, women I wouldn't have met. And gosh, if I had another 100 years of life, I could do a lot of stories on stage.
You're just mining the list for your content. I know.
There are so many. I mean, and they're all ages. It's not just, elderly people like me in their 70s. It's young people who are out there forging amazing paths. And it makes me realize how wonderful it is when women are the place that we are in now, thinking in the 50s when I was growing up, there were really very few avenues still for women. Women were, you know, they were important women in society, but not many. And certainly you didn't expect them to be going into law and politics and education, certainly. I mean, it was sort of education or the caring industries or secretary or nursing, those kind of things, but or the arts and to a degree. But to have women in such not only powerful positions, but positions in the community where they can contribute so much and be recognized for it is very exciting. So yeah. I think it's a wonderful institution from that point of view, raising the level of awareness. And they do a lot, even for things like talking about violence against women and those things. It's a very powerful tool.
Yes, the impact of women has not gone unnoticed and definitely has not gone unheard. And that includes yourself, Jenny. Thank you.
Thank you, Taylor.
And thank you for being part of Herstory.
Thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
Thanks to Jenny Davis and all the women at the WA Women's Hall of Fame. And thanks to the incredible women who make Herstory happen. Our executive producer is Danae Gibson. Sophie Minisale and Madeline Lombardi are our assistant producers. Emily Jane Reid is our production assistant. Our theme music is an original composition from Annika Moses with artwork from Peter Roebuck. Herstory is an RTRFM podcast series about women in the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. This podcast is produced on Whadjuk Noongar Boodja. RTRFM acknowledges and pays respects to the Aboriginal elders of this land, past and present. These lands were never ceded. This podcast was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find out more at cbf.org.au. My name's Taylor Strano. Join us next week when we take a trip to Parliament with one of the most influential politicians to change the course of reproductive rights in the state's history.
Songlines is a new RTRFM podcast shining a light on First Nations artists across WA. Join me, Zara Kudishnaz, as I sit down with creatives across music, theatre, dance and television, paving the way for the next generation of storytellers. Stream now on iTunes, Spotify and rtrfm.com.au.